Welcome, everybody. Thanks for your patience while I've been faffing around with all these things. Welcome to our second Kurdish Tuesday. I'm Sarah Glynn. I'm co-convener of Scottish Solidarity with Kurdistan. And the idea of these Tuesdays is actually that there'll be different groups that are running it, different themes, but one diary date, so we know that every other Tuesday, to keep it free in the diary for a meeting about Kurdistan and Kurdish issues. And it's a way of bringing together an international community. And it's really exciting, actually, that this opportunity to realise that there are all those people out there, you know, even outside Scotland, but, you know, even further outside the UK that are taking part and that we're all part of the same thing. And I hope very much that that part can go on after we're through this pandemic. Though I do miss that bit of the meeting when you go for a drink afterwards and actually get a chance to really hammer things out. So, yeah, I've been looking forward to meeting some of you in for real afterwards. So this meeting is actually being run by Kurdistan Solidarity Network. But just before I hand over to them, I just want to tell you about the meeting that we've got in a fortnight's time. And really excited that we've got Jan Furman, who's the lawyer who led the legal team that successfully defended the PKK or members of the PKK against charges of terrorism right up through the Belgian court system. So that will be really interesting in 2 weeks' time. But for the moment, we're going to be really interested in democratic confederalism, despite it being such a mouthful. And really excited to hand over to Kurdistan Solidarity Network and Nick, and just sit back and listen and let a few people in. So handing over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Sarah. And thank you so much to Scottish Solidarity with Kurdistan for the invitation. It's really great to be here and to be talking about democratic confederalism in practice on the ground in northeast Syria or Rojava. Just a brief intro to the Kurdistan Solidarity Network. So my name's Nick. I'm an organizer with KSN based in London. And KSN is a network of local groups in the island of Britain, all in England at the moment, which are building practical solidarity with the Rojava Revolution and the Kurdish Freedom Movement, and are looking to learn specifically from the politics of this movement and to spread the ideas beyond Kurdistan and in our own context. And in doing this, it's important in the principles of the movement that we organize really closely with our friends in different organizations across these islands and beyond. So working really closely with Kurdish Solidarity Cymru and, of course, Scottish Solidarity with Kurdistan. So totally agree that hopefully these meetings can continue in person and online beyond the current crisis, and we can continue building this solidarity movement. But for today, we're joined by one of our organisers, Vian, to talk about democratic confederalism in practice. And to start, maybe Vian, you can tell us a bit about yourself and what you're going to be talking to us about today.
Sure. First of all, thank you everybody for tuning in. It's really fantastic that there's lots of people from all different places. So as Nick said, my name is Vian. I'm an organizer with Kurdish Solidarity Network, and I just sort of recently come back from a year in Rojava, where I was working as an internationalist volunteer, and I went over early last year in order to participate with the revolution and join the movement structures and see what we can learn from the movement in northeast Syria and in Kurdistan. So as part of my time there, I was super lucky to be able to speak to lots of people from just sort of residents in the cities, people living in the villages, to people who were involved in the institutions and assemblies and structures and in positions of responsibility, and talk to them about what is it like to live in democratic confederalism. How does it affect their life? And we also got to learn about the big structures and sort of like match up the comparison between people's lived experience of it every day and then the big picture vision, the big picture structures. So I'll be talking a bit about the actual structures of democratic confederalism. It's important to flag up that there's also a lot of questions around political culture and practices, as well as the ideological background. And there are other seminars that we've done as Kurdistan Solidarity Network that cover those aspects, which are absolutely crucial. But today we'll focus a little bit about the political structures of the political system.
Thanks. So let's get into it then. So North and East Syria doesn't have a government in the traditional sense of the word. So you can tell us a bit about what that means?
Mm-hmm. The reason why people all across the world have looked to Northeast Syria as a example of what direct democracy can look like at a time when all around the world we're becoming more and more disillusioned with the state structures and the state governments that we live in is because it proposes a way of governance which doesn't include a government. So it's essentially society governing itself. And in the social contract and in the outlines of all the different assemblies and bodies, it says, we reject the concept of a state. We reject the concept of a nationalistic, capitalist, oppressive state. We see it as a relationship of domination. So instead, we're gonna set up a system of people governing themselves through a confederation. So starting from the smallest unit possible and then federating up to the biggest one. I wanted to make a quick note on terminology, which is that we kind of use Rojava and Northeast Syria interchangeably. Rojava generally refers to a smaller area of the three regions of Afrin, Kobani, and Jazeera, which were declared independent in 2012. And then Northeast Syria actually includes four more regions. So it's a bigger space, but they all fall under this confederation. So even though we use them kind of interchangeably, we're actually speaking about North and East Syria, which is a part of a population of roughly 4 million people and about a third of the area of the whole Syrian state is within this area. So it's quite a sizable chunk. So when we're thinking about it, we really need to think big and not just think about, kind of the much smaller scale examples. So it's a counter proposition to the nation state, but it can also exist within and alongside the state, which is really interesting. So they're not trying to gain power in the Syrian state in order to gain or to gain an autonomous state. They're saying, it's fine, we're doing our own thing. We have a certain level of autonomy and we can coexist within any state structure that we happen to be existing within. And our goal is to build up our own power so that we either render the state irrelevant or when it comes to a confrontation of some kind, we're able to defend ourselves against the state and assert that autonomy. But it doesn't see the state as either the kind of solution as part of democratic confederalism. So it's based on a lot of principles which drive the structure, which is gender equality, youth empowerment, ethnic diversity, and devolved power. So the system devolves power into communes, which are usually between 150 and 1,000 people, though some can be a bit bigger, all the way up to this federation across the seven regions. Nick, if you can pull up the picture of the general overview of the political system, we have a nice little visual aid here, which was provided by Rojava Information Center, who have produced some interesting material on this topic that I would really recommend. So there's essentially three wings or three bodies of the political system of North and East Syria. The one that most people kind of refer to as the governance structure is the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, sometimes also called the Self-Administration of North and East Syria. Then we also have the Syrian Democratic Council, and then we also have TevDem. Now, these bodies have all come into being at different times. The Autonomous Administration has only come into being in September 2018, so it's the most recent body, but it's actually taken a lot of the responsibilities that were previously held by either the Syrian Democratic Council or TevDem, which a lot of people have heard of because of the history of the revolution. And it has become the governance body based on democratic and federalist principles, which takes over, which looks at all issues like education, economy, agriculture, transportation, health systems. So all of these things, all these essentially kind of services and ways of living and democratic input happen through the autonomous administration. So the way that that looks like is that you have your commune in your local area, and then your communes in a neighborhood federate together and become a neighborhood. And then your neighborhoods federate together and become a sub-district, and so on, up through district, canton, region, and then the full autonomous administration, North and East Syria, across all seven regions. It's important to remember, though, that the autonomous administration isn't just that top level of all seven regions. The administration is the whole thing, from the commune up to the federation. And the power is devolved as much as possible, so that if it's a question of sort of transportation between two regions, the administrations, the councils of those two regions would have to coordinate. But if it's a question of something that only affects within one region, that can be dealt with within that region. If it's a question of, you know, setting up a park or cleaning up a river, a commune can handle it. If it's a question of a municipal question of how do we organize the cleaning services in a city, then it gets handled in the municipal assembly. So it's really about pushing stuff down as much as possible, but bringing it back up again when necessary. All right, so that's the administration, the autonomous administration. Then we have the political body, which is what the political parties participate in, and also administration feeds into, civil society and labor unions participate into, and also some key individuals, for example, like the head military commanders will feed into, and that's the Syrian Democratic Council. And they're the political vision for all of Syria. They're the ones who are actually doing more diplomatic work. So it's the Syrian Democratic Council who will be holding negotiations with the Assad regime. They're the ones who send a delegation out to the USA in order to speak to Congress about the, you know, Turkish invasion. And they also organize with lots of different bodies in Syria and across Kurdistan and across the world. And then finally, you have Tevdem, which is essentially a way that this governance structure has incorporated and enshrined the importance of civil society and labor unions within the system. So civil society associations, community groups, and labor unions are held within Tevdem, and Tevdem will provide a confederated structure, again, from the commune all the way up to the inter-region level, which gives voice to those bodies, to those groups. And then they all feed into each other. So if you look at the diagram, if you can see at all levels, they feed into each other. They all organize by councils and committees. So they're all sitting on each other's committees. And throughout this kind of like three-legged stool, the governance of the region happens. And because it's all federated from the bottom level to the top, it creates space for society to govern itself.
Thank you. That's a really rich overview, and really shows where this system departs from the kinds of systems of government that that we're really used to. But you pointed out that we often use the term Rojava to refer to the whole system, and really we often use the phrase Rojava revolution. So what is it that makes could you say a bit more about the political principles and the culture that this system is based on and which really makes it revolutionary?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the principles it's based on. So, for example, gender equality, youth empowerment, ethnic diversity. In terms of what that looks like in practice, so for all of these structures, Tevdem, the Syrian Democratic Council, and the administration, there is a parallel women's structure from the commune level up to the interregional level. So whether it's in a political party or a labor union or in one of the administration councils, because they have a council on almost every level, then there is a women's parallel structure, which is fully democratic, fully autonomous, and essentially exercises veto power on any decision. But it's not just veto, it's that they actually really shape, you know, and drive and are seen explicitly as the political leadership, as the, you know, vanguard of the movement, because it's really seen that because women have been excluded from the political system and are oppressed by the political system, oppressed by capitalism, they've actually found different ways of organizing, and they sort of hold the heritage of democratic organizing by virtue of having been those people who've been excluded from the dominating systems. So it's really a tangible transfer of power to women in a way that means that the system's really shaped by it. So that's kind of one way that it's practiced. And just to be really clear, it's not that there's a men's structure and a women's structure. It's a general mixed structure which already has 40% quotas for women. And then in addition to that, you have a fully autonomous women's structure. Each of the councils and committees on the administration level operates by a co-chair system. So you never have one person in charge, you always have two people in charge, and it's always a man and a woman. It can never be two men. In the women's structures, you often still have co-chairs, but they'll obviously both be women. So if you actually think about it, even if there's a 40% minimum quota in the mixed structure, then you have 100% women organizing an equally powerful women's structure. So you kind of have like, what is that, three quarters of the people who are taking the leadership positions in the assemblies are women. So it's really not a token, it's definitely not a token response. The youth movement is also seen as autonomous. They're not usually as kind of organized, as kind of structurally organized as the women's movement, but it's really, youth are held up as also one of the leaders of the revolution, because the analysis is that it's generally kind of the older generations, especially the older male generations, who kind of hold on to power in a conservative and dominating way. So the kind of dynamism and, you know, visionary ability of youth is really valued. So the youth also have autonomy and they organize their own structures. And feed into at every level. So for example, in the Syrian Democratic Council, so this, you know, top level council, which sends, which makes really big decisions, sends diplomats out to different countries, there are youth representatives in that council who organize with that council. In terms of ethnic diversity, there's also an insistence on representation. And so if you look at the kind of committee breakdown, so each committee, so for example, education committee, women's committee, economy committee, self-defense committee, culture committee, pretty much every council has these committees, will have two co-chairs and two vice co-chairs, again, half women, half men, and every ethnic community who lives in an area will be represented in the committees that make up a council. So if there are a handful of Turkmen or Circassians or a large minority or a majority of one ethnicity or another, they will always be represented. It's not a proportional representation because it's saying it doesn't matter if there's only, you know, 30 Turkmen families in this city, they should be represented, even if, you know, then there's 90%, you know, Kurdish or, you know, 50% Arab and 45% Kurdish, and really insisting that minorities don't just get trampled over as well.
Thanks, that's a really rich answer. So I have lots more questions, particularly thinking about what it would look like translating some of these practices into our own context. But maybe at this point, we could get some more questions from the people who are in the call at the moment, and hear what they've got to say. So I've got a first question from Neil.
Hi there. I wonder if you could say something about the economic structures that you've got in the area, perhaps to do with the cooperatives that I believe are there, and how people trade, how people do commerce, stuff like that. That'd be interesting if you could tell us anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Are we taking one question and then, or doing questions in bundles? And
So there's only that question for the moment. So maybe answer that one and other people can, because sort of threw the questions on people so they can take a bit of time to think.
Great question. And it's really interesting. And in some ways, I wish I knew more about it. And there might actually be some other people who have stuff they want to contribute. So as part of my time there, we visited quite a lot of economic cooperatives, which are generally place-based. So some of them are quite small ones that have come out of a local commune. Other ones have been set up on a bigger level by the regional administration or district. So there are a lot of cooperatives. It's very much a budding cooperative economy, though. Cooperatives are seen as sort of the vision of a really important part of a sort of anti-capitalist economy, so to speak. I think it's important to recognize that there a lot of them are really struggling. A lot of them are doing really well, too. But, you know, it's kind of like a slowly, slowly thing. And part of that is just the material challenges that they're faced with. Embargo, invasion, the fact that the autonomous administration is not recognized as a political body by a lot of the international actors like the UN because it's not a state. And the fact that it doesn't even try to be a state means that other, you know, bodies which might in some ways engage with them just don't even know what to do with them. So a lot of aid and infrastructure funding is funneled away from administration and instead goes directly to the Assad regime, who then keeps it away from North and East Syria. So a lot of this kind of like infrastructural resources that could really benefit a cooperative economy just never make it to Northeast Syria. That said, what the administration has accomplished is amazing. So there are a lot of agricultural cooperatives, things like tree nurseries, vegetable farms, seedling farms, gardens, as well as just like run-of-the-mill sort of like food packaging plants, crisp factories, linen factories, soap factories, things like that. Some of them really small, like tailoring workshops, other ones actually quite big. There's also, and they interact with the administration through the economy committees of the councils. So the cooperatives will then be engaged in the governance structures as well, and will then feed into all the different levels. There's also a bit of almost a cultural or a mindset shift that needs to happen. So some of the kind of self-criticism that a lot of people in the administration and the economic works of the administration have made is that they've kind of implemented the system of a cooperative economy without really maybe providing enough education and culture shift about what it means to have a cooperative. So instead of having, for example, like an agricultural cooperative, which is truly democratic and sort of owned, run, and worked on by the people of an area, a group of people will pool their resources and then hire laborers to come in and do all the work and still call it a cooperative. And so that's kind of a big discussion that's been happening, and the administration has realized, okay, there's a lot of things which are saying they're cooperative, but are cooperatives only in name and not in practice? So we're actually gonna start phasing those out, do a lot of education, and also do things like really make sure that cooperatives are tied to specific communes or neighborhoods in order to give them a more democratic, rooted in society structure, instead of just being able, it's just a different business. So that's the kind of cooperative section of the economy, still quite small. Then there's the private economy that includes a lot of sort of small business owners, shops, taxis, things like that. And then you also have a lot of smuggling and black market. And the administration, to an extent, just needs to allow that to happen because it brings goods into the region at a time that's actually really difficult to bring goods into the region. So there's the private economy, and then they also have unions and professional associations, which are channeled through TevDem. So that's how they feed into the political system. And then you have essentially the bigger sort of administration-run economy. So you have the bigger sort of like eco-industrial projects. Like there's some really interesting stuff in a lot of the economy committees on the higher level where they're going, okay, we really want to foster smaller grassroots cooperative economy, but what about the bigger stuff? How do we feed 4 million people? How do we become economically, and kind of how do we achieve food sovereignty? How do we feed ourselves? how do we give people work and how do we do it as ecologically as possible. So actually quite a lot of the economy is also run by the administration itself. And then it's also important to mention that there's, through all this as well, like a very strong gender element. So Aburiya Jin, which is women's economy, which is run by the economy committee of the women's section of the Eton's administration in partnership with Congress Star, which is like the women's sort of civil society movement organization, create and support a lot of women's economic initiatives, provide a huge amount of sort of training and skill sharing between women, both just women who live in a commune, but also, for example, a lot of women who escaped abusive marriages will then be specifically trained up to have a skill that they can enter a cooperative with, so supporting the women's economy of that as well. And similarly to why women are seen as the political leaders of the movement, there's also an understanding that, again, because women have been marginalized by and dominated by capitalism, and that capitalism is actually intrinsically tied up with patriarchy, women are able to create new ways of working in terms of economy, which don't just replicate. So the idea isn't to integrate women into a capitalist economy, but to actually nurture a new kind of economy, which is led by women, and of pretty much anti-capitalist, pro-democracy, pro-society, pro-liberation principles. And then that necessarily needs to be ecological. There are a huge amount of challenges to creating a sort of, to make Rojava an ecological project. Like, there's a lot of amazing work happening, but there's a lot of challenges as well. We probably don't have time to go into all of them, but it's really amazing to see people really look at those economic questions and say, okay, on the one hand, we want to be really sustainable, and on the other hand, we're in a region that is, you know, under embargo and under attack a lot of the time. How do we feed the 4 million people who live here? And really seeing people juggle those questions, but always hold both of them. And that's something that I wanted to mention today. I think one of those things that makes, that we should think about more here is how we can avoid this sort of binary thinking, which kind of thinks, well, you have to either choose one thing or another. You know, this is either good or bad, but actually say, you know what, when we have to make really difficult choices, when we're talking about how we actually build community power and build our society structures up to a point where we actually hold and exercise power, we're going to have to make a lot of difficult decisions. So how are we able to hold both of those things, which are important, and work through the kind of like the gritty spots and the contradictions and the tensions? And I think that the sort of ecology and survival tensions are really there in Rojava, and it's really amazing to see that being navigated by the administration.
Thanks, Fionn. That was really rich answer, and goes back to one of the questions that I'd asked earlier about what makes this revolutionary, because there's a very fixed image of what a revolution looks like because of these traditions of the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the mass expropriations that came along with it, and that didn't happen here. But when you look that in 8 years now in Jizire, which is the northeast of northeast Syria, Aburiya Jin, the women's economy movement that you mentioned, said last week to some friends who are working on a project with them together that now 6% of Jizire Canton's economy is women's cooperatives. So it really shows how you can be both pragmatic and principled in a revolution and create really dramatic change that is ongoing, as you were saying. But I think there's a friend here with the name S. Hunt who was going to ask a question. So I'm just going to unmute you now and you can ask your question to Bian.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, I'm unmuted. Thanks, Fionn. Very interesting so far. Just actually, my question is linked to probably the end of what you were talking about, balancing difficult choices. And I was my question was around where there are points of disagreement. So if you've got a disagreement on an issue, is it a simple majority? Is it do you carry on with consensus decision making until you thrash it out? Would you have a supermajority or other mechanisms? Because I think we probably all, direct democracy and participatory democracy can mean slightly different things in terms of the particular constitution. So that was the area I was interested in.
Cool. Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that because it's actually a really interesting question. So part of the beauty and richness of democratic federalism is that the sort of decisions about how decisions are made are also devolved. So you'll actually have different communes, different assemblies, different committees making decisions in different ways. Even running elections in different ways. I mean, elections is a really messy topic and we're not going to get too into it because it's just not actually that interesting to most people. But elections are run in different ways in different areas, partly just because of the sort of like material reality of the situation. So for example, like in Minbij, which is one of the regions, they didn't run elections in order to get the current people who are holding kind of committee positions in power because it was just after the area had been liberated from ISIS and just wasn't the right time to have elections. Actually, you would have come up with a less democratic result if you just ran open ballots, as opposed to what they did do, which is that they went around to lots of different community groups, associations, community leaders, existing, you know, organizations and structures and said, hey, who can you imagine on some kind of council in order to run this region? And that's how they created the council, which at some point is going to be elected, and they're trying to do it through elections. But at the time, it just actually wouldn't have been more democratic to have elections. And then in other places, they'll just decide to do things in a slightly different way. Like in some places, the way that they incorporate the municipality bodies into the sort of district is different than others, because again, it just depends on the local circumstances and they get to decide. So in terms of the actual decision-making processes, people do vote. People also kind of do sort of informal consensus. I've never seen any of the kind of like formal consensus rules that we exercise often in kind of UK left culture, where we have the kind of like objections and direct points and the hand waving and stuff. Like that's definitely not in the political culture there. And it's more of a consensus in terms of, you know, we're going to discuss these issues because we need to come to a solution and we need to come to a good solution. So we need to involve everybody in order to do that. That said, I think that the people who participate in economic structures are so aware of the risks of what would happen if they fail to come to a decision and take action that you don't get the same situation where it's just like a complete like dead end of people who allegedly agree with each other. I think it's also important to mention that there is like a lot of like leadership. So people who are the co-chairs and the co-vice chairs do hold power.
Vian, yeah, you somehow got muted there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Okay, fantastic, cool.
The last that I heard was leadership.
So there is leadership and you don't kind of get the situation where like a whole group of people all try to thrash out the kind of like proposal or whatever together. Quite often there'll be a discussion, people will raise their points, people will raise their concerns, and then the co-chairs will go off and make a decision based on that. But it's a leadership that's accountable, that's transparent, that's recallable, and that's open to criticism. And those mechanisms for giving feedback, evaluation, criticism are very embedded in the process. So you don't have to wait until the next round of elections or to tell somebody like, you shouldn't have done that. That wasn't in line with what we wanted you to do. But there definitely is a lot of trust. And, you know, it's running essentially like a government structure, right? It's running everything for 4 million people. So you don't have this kind of like, you know, fairy tale idea of what direct democracy looks like. It does require delegation. It does require trust and just saying, okay, I don't quite agree with that, but I'm just going to let it go.
Thanks. So we've got quite a few questions now. I've got two from the chat from this call itself, and then there's one from the Facebook that I'll ask myself as well. So I'll go with the first one that I saw pop up. So this is a friend who has the username 7EVPM2. And then I'll ask the question from the Facebook and then come to Margaret Gallagher. So you should be unmuted now, so you can ask your question. We can hear you now, so 7EVPM2. So if you wanted to ask your question. Hello. Okay, I might, maybe we can come back to the friend. And since Margaret is here in the chat and the friend wasn't there, Margaret, why don't you ask your question?
I just wanted to ask, the health service and the hospitals would probably already be under pressure. So how are they managing with the coronavirus pandemic?
Can you say
that
again?
About the health service, the hospitals, how are they managing in the coronavirus pandemic? They were all probably already under a lot of pressure before that.
Mm-hmm.
How are they managing currently in the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll do my best to answer that. And it's mostly based on just, I'm still in touch with quite a lot of friends who are over there, including those working in the health sector. So I'll give a response on that. But I also know that there have been kind of more official communications about it. Essentially, like, yes, the hospitals are under pressure in general because a lot of the hospital capacity was destroyed during the most recent Turkish invasion in October last year. So, you know, you get to a point where, you know, north and east Syria, again, population of 4 million people, has something like 40 respirators and 35 sort of critical care beds. So the capacity is tiny compared to what we have here. There have been cases of coronavirus in north and east Syria, specifically in Hasakeh, which is one of the big urban centers in the east. And that's been kind of like relationships with the Assad regime have really made it hard to effectively diagnose, because in Rojava they don't have any testing capacity. So the tests have to get sent to the Assad regime in Damascus. And they've actually been quite obstructive in sending the results back. So then you have like actually a period of 2 weeks where the virus can potentially be spreading. So there was some quite a strict lockdown quarantine that came into place around the same time as the UK went into lockdown. And then it became contained around Hasakeh where the cases emerged. And then since then it's mostly been dissolved when they're kind of, you know, seeing what's gonna happen. But I know that the administration is working on increasing health service capacity, and that's been something that once the coronavirus pandemic kind of came, showed up on the horizon, they started building more kind of critical care units, isolation wards, and things like that. And they also, this is when the communes came into action in order to, when people were in lockdown, the communes were able to distribute food and gas and other essentials as well, and the administration organized a lot of disinfection and so on. Currently, it doesn't seem like there's an overwhelming number of cases. How that's going to play out is completely uncertain. There is a Rojava Information Center report that came out in the last few weeks outlining the situation and some potential scenarios. But another thing to flag up about the health system, which is mostly run by the autonomous administration, there's also some kind of private and some NGO-run hospitals and health facilities as well. It's also one of the sectors that's been really damaged by the fact that a lot of international humanitarian bodies don't deal directly with the autonomous administration because it's not a state. So again, all of that aid, for example, the World Health Organization, the United Nations HCR, and I think the World Food Program, they all go through Damascus, which means that North and East Syria really gets excluded. So there's been times that, for example, the humanitarian bodies who are acting in North and East Syria actually have to put money into the private medical facilities because they're not allowed to give resources and put them into the autonomous administration run health facilities. So it's really, you know, both like a lack of access to short-term humanitarian aid, but also something that down the road is going to be really damaging because this vital infrastructure that can be all essentially democratically owned and run through the administration is, instead of being investing into that, it's investing into private hospitals. But actually quite a lot of NGOs, for example, Médecins Sans Frontières, so Doctors Without Borders, have chosen to stop working with Damascus, and they just say we're actually not going to work with the Assad regime anymore, and they work in North and East Syria instead.
Thanks, Fionn. So I think we can go back to the other friend, who is Murat. And you can ask your question now, and then I'll. There's a few questions that have come up on the Facebook live stream as well. So once Murat has asked, I'll ask those. So you should ask now.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I apologize for the inconvenience. I was confused with my automatic ID name. I have, in fact, two questions regarding the ecological aspect of this sort of reorganizing society in Rojava. First one is related to agriculture. To what extent the revolution there has informed the monoculture there. So, in fact, is monoculture so popular in Rojava? In fact, I don't know about that. And then if it is the case, how the revolution kind of trying to rebuild the agriculture system based on non-monoculture agriculture. In fact, this is the first question, and the second one is related to the oil extraction. How it is dealt with in Rojava? How, you know, the process of oil extraction for now or for future is kind of organized based on the ecological concern. Thank you so much.
Thank you for those questions. Really fascinating issue, and one that's full of, contradictions and beautiful ideas and, you know, devastating realities and limitations. So as many of you probably know, the Assad regime and the Ba'athist regime imposed a monocultural agricultural system on North and East Syria because in general it's quite a sort of breadbasket region. It has really good agricultural soil. It was made to produce a huge amount of wheat, cotton, and some barley, and actually transferred from more traditional and sustainable techniques into this monoculture in order to then feed the economy of the regime. So all this wheat and cotton and barley was then being sent to the regime for processing. And to a large extent, this is still the case. Wheat and cotton, I mean, they are the cash crops, and they are also something that the economy really relies on and that people really rely on as well. And the administration, the revolutionary movement, is trying really hard to do a lot of education, a lot of research, and again, setting up like these cooperatives, which are a lot more around kind of polyculture and more sustainable methods, as well as setting up sort of embedding that ecological approach into a community basis. So not just kind of seeing it as something that's really separate, like ecology happens over here, but choosing certain places where these different approaches can be trialed in a way that's really incorporated into community life. So two examples are Jinwar, which is the women's village that a lot of people have heard about, which is a women's village for women and their children who come to live together democratically and freely. And as part of that project, they run a cooperative village economy, which includes some harvesting lentils, chickpeas, wheat, but also like a vegetable patch, also like goats and sheep. And so they kind of incorporate, and then they manage it collectively. Everybody who lives in the village takes part in that. And then they receive their kind of monthly income from the cooperative village economy. So again, they've really embedded it into that project. And that was kind of like a build from scratch kind of project. So in some ways it's almost easier because you can kind of, the people self-select into it. Another example is the village of Jarudi, which is outside the town of Derek, the city of Derek, which we would visit quite a lot because there was a guy there who was just so passionate about ecology and community and education and internationalism that he would always invite us over when they were doing, harvesting or having like big celebrations and so on. And so this is an already existing village where they've been trying to bring in more of an ecological aspect, and they set up like a community garden, and they've started having a few fields that are grown and worked and sort of sold and processed cooperatively by the village. So everybody in the village comes in, they get to decide what they're gonna grow in those fields. They help with the harvest and with the processing, and then they're able to share in the harvest either through the finished product or through the income if they sell it. But it's a really difficult process because a lot of people just aren't interested in doing that. They've got their other work, or they've got their other ideas of what they want to be doing with their time. So it's a big question of social organizing, of community organizing. And I think the movement's really aware that it's many, many years of work in order to actually incorporate ecology into people's lives. And often you have to start in a place where people are more quickly kind of agree with. So for example, in Jarudi, something they started off with was litter picking. And they said, we have a beautiful village. Why is there trash in the streets? So they started organizing collective litter picks. And then they built up to the community garden, and they built up to the collective cooperative field. And now they've built a big community center. And it's kind of about this like really slowly, slowly bringing people in, long-term vision kind of way. So, there's also the kind of interesting thing where, again, avoiding the binary thinking in terms of strategy, the movement has really invested in some small areas which would kind of like pilot or try out new things and really go very deep in the practice of kind of having an ecological approach, a sustainable approach, while at the same time also having this overarching approach as well, which means that you have these pockets of like amazing practice and then a general layer of growing awareness. And I think that combination is really important. And also when we think about organizing in the UK, when we're thinking, okay, are we organizing nationally or locally? Are we community organizing or building something really big? Is actually figuring out how we can do that both. How can we create these pockets of deep practice, connect them together, and then distribute them around like the whole area in order for us to kind of learn from each other and draw strength from each other and kind of bring everybody along on the journey together. The question around oil extraction is also really interesting because, how can a revolutionary movement, which one of its like main pillars is ecological sustainability, how can they have oil extraction as one of their sort of main economic activities? And it is, as people in the movement say, a contradiction. Like, it's not perfect. There is still oil extraction happening in mostly Rimelon and Deir Ezzor. It is a major source of income for the administration, and it's also a huge part of people's lives. They're used to having cheap diesel that they use to heat the houses, run the generators, do all sorts of kind of basic things. And there are, there is an increasing amount of sort of solar panels coming in, of passive water heating, things like that, trying to get the dams that are already built, trying to get them working at full capacity. And the interesting thing as well is that in the in like the university body for people who are studying fossil fuel and energy in Rimelon, part of the curriculum of people who are going into fossil fuel extraction is about sustainability. It's really understanding what's the impact of fossil fuels and how do we do it in as sustainable way as possible? How do we transition out of it? So even though the movement at this time is saying, right now we can't quite survive without our oil extraction, they're still putting into place the stuff for the future to transition out of it. And also like there's a amazing agricultural research centers where they're taking samples of soil everywhere and really analyzing it, trying out different seeds in different places, trying to have the kind of information and test run ready so that as things get picked up more and more, as they're able to, either because of capacity or economy or because there's finally enough peacetime, to do these kinds of projects, they have the information already at their disposal to say, try growing these crops. These ones work really well in this climate. These ones might work really well, you know, in your region. So I think that ability to balance short-term action, but also that long-term perspective is quite interesting.
Thanks so much, Vianne. So we've got four and a half questions that have come to us either through the Facebook chat or in the chat here, which I'll ask shortly. And I think this will be the last round of questions. So if people are quick enough to get their hands up or ask a question now, then we can include them. Otherwise, after these questions, I've got a couple of summing up questions. And then we've got some shout outs as well for different campaigns going on at the moment. But before we come to that, so on the Facebook, Irina Shokenko asked, firstly, is this strategy, the model in Rojava, a proposal which is socially accepted by the rest of the Kurdish territories? So I guess in Turkish, Iraqi, and Iranian Kurdistan. And I think connected to this, Mohammed Chakri on the Facebook also asked about the relationship between the KRG and the autonomous administration, particularly with these issues about medical assistance, whether that can come through the KRG rather than from the Assad regime. So those are two questions about the relationship to other parts of Kurdistan. Then Irina also asked, on Rojava, on northeast Syria in particular, what the idea is on taxation and how to manage common welfare related to money and these sorts of things. Also on the Facebook, Ulise Pitsi asked an interesting question, which apart from the Turkish invasion and the threat of the Turkish state, and I guess also the other external things like the relationship with the Assad regime, things like that. What are the inner contradictions, you would say, of this revolutionary system? And just finally, Paul in the chat also asked, in light of the Turkish invasion at the end of last year, and the need for the Syrian Democratic Forces, for the Syrian Democratic Council and the autonomous administration led by Ilhan Ahmed, because of their need to enter into an agreement with the Assad regime, out of survival, obviously, how is this hampering the possibility of the model that you've outlined, how's it limiting the possibility of that developing further? And particularly Paul's asking about the genealogy component, the women-led decision-making, the women-led courts, also Yepyjen and the other structures where the women's movement is leading. So I think, let me just make sure I haven't missed anyone. Yeah, those will be the last questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a lot of questions, a lot of ground, and there's definitely going to be some areas that I'm less knowledgeable about, but I'll do my best with the knowledge I have. And I see that I think it's Joe is signposting lots of resources in the chat as well, so please do check those out too. So first, just a quick response to the question of like the KRG and whether humanitarian aid can enter through the KRG. So this is kind of where we get into like kind of really sort of boring technical international law stuff around kind of like how humanitarian aid is distributed in different areas, but essentially in kind of one nation state, because the United Nations and a lot of other humanitarian actors are focused on a nation state framework, they can say, for example, you can only have one registered office of United Nations HRC or of an international NGO or, for example, the International Committee for the Red Cross. So there's only one official Red Cross in all of northeast Syria. Heva Sor, Kurdish Red Crescent, technically isn't like acknowledged as a legitimate Red Cross actor because it's not the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, which is the Assad-backed Red Cross, because that's the official one. So there's kind of all sorts of sort of technicalities around that, but essentially what a lot of NGOs who do want to work with North and East Syria do is that they set up regional offices and they operate as cross-border NGOs. They'll have an office in KRG which is the Kurdish regional government of Iraq, or in Jordan, or in Egypt, or just sort of in any place where they can then send people in to do the work in North and East Syria, but then they're actually not officially registered in Syria. They're acting cross-border. So it's kind of one of those technicalities which highlights that the limitations of a humanitarian system and a global governance system, which is based on nation states, such as the UN. I think we need to be really aware of that, that it's the framework that's wrong. And even though we can try to get the United Nations to kind of work more directly with the North, the Thomas administration, and they do through these kind of like backwards, like behind the scenes kind of like ways, that actually it's the system that needs to change. It's not just about creating essentially loopholes for places like North and East Syria. Like, that should be the norm, that regions which are governing themselves should be able to access humanitarian aid when they're being attacked from, you know, various sides. Humanitarian aid does get sent in from KRG, and this relates to the question around whether the democratic and federalism proposal is accepted across all of Kurdistan. There, you know, when Turkey attacked in October, you know, we met a lot of volunteers coming in from KRG, from the Kurdish region of Iraq, who are coming to join the Syrian Democratic Forces in order to defend Rojava against Turkish attack, even though the KRG government, which is led by the Barzani clan, and represents a very different kind of proposal, like a very capitalist, a very nationalist, a very sort of like pro-neoliberal side, is actually working more closely with Turkey than they do with the administration. So there are definitely tensions across Kurdistan, and it's not uniform. You know, in Baku or in the Kurdish region of Turkey, there's a very strong democratic and federalist movement that's been incredibly oppressed and marginalized by the Turkish state, which has really shown its fascist colors, essentially by how hard they've cracked down on democratic and federalist organizing in the Turkish region of, in the Kurdish region of Turkey, in Bakur, where upwards of 10,000, you know, teachers, community organizers, mayors, democratically elected representatives are all in jail because they were participating in a democratic and federalist project. So it really varies. In every region of Kurdistan, there are multiple political tendencies present. And within Rojava, within Northeast Syria, there's also multiple tendencies present. And the more sort of Barzani-influenced political parties organized under ENKS. There was some news recently that came out that I unfortunately don't know the details of, where there actually has finally been some kind of agreement, a breakthrough between those political parties who've been mostly boycotting the political project in North and East Syria, and the PYD, which is one of the main political parties who've been promoting the democratic and federalist. And maybe Nick or Sarah, if one of you knows more about it, you can chip in. But there definitely are multiple tendencies, and the democratic and federalist project aims to be able to incorporate all the different voices as much as possible. Like, all these political parties have been invited to sit around the table in the Syrian Democratic Council, but many of them have chosen not to. The question about taxation, I'm going to say I wish I knew more about that, but I don't really know the specifics of taxation. But yeah, if anybody does, please signpost resources in the chat. One thing I will say is that between the different regions, resources are distributed. So for example, the regions that have a lot of fossil fuels and therefore have that kind of cash income through them, that's redistributed throughout the region. So even though regions have a certain degree of autonomy over their own economies and resources, if it gets to the point where, for example, one region would then become really wealthy and another one wouldn't because of how the global economic system works, then that's redistributed through the councils, and that would be through the democratic councils of the Thomas administration, which includes representatives from all of the different bodies in each region. So then that's decided democratically, and they need to reach some kind of decision on that. Oh, and there's more questions. What are the threats and challenges and inner contradictions? So outside of the threats. So I guess partly it's the different, there's the political tensions of the kind of political constituencies who disagree with the democratic and federalist project. One thing I was really amazed by is how much patience a lot of the kind of really dedicated organizers in Rojava have when they're working with people who really disagree with where they're coming from. And that includes both the people who disagree and refuse to participate, or the ones who are participating but are actually coming from very different perspectives. So for example, a lot of the more conservative Arab tribes in some of the southern regions come in with, you know, polygamy being kind of a standard practice, refusing to have a female co-chair in their committees and their assemblies, and coming from a really different perspective and often having quite an undemocratic, you know, they're not running an assembly for their district or for their neighborhood. They're just kind of making decisions in the same way as they would have before, but kind of feeding into the democratic and federal system. So it's a really interesting tension between at what point do you say, at what point do you say, well, that's too far from our foundational principles of women's liberation, sustainability, and grassroots democracy? And what point do you say, hey, it's better to have you on board and to include you, and therefore in the long term to work towards democratic future together, as opposed to saying, oh, that's too far, we can't include you? And that's the kind of like really big decisions which are being juggled all the time. And in general, I've seen the movement come down on the side of, this is a project for everyone. This is a project for all of society. And if we start picking and choosing, no, you can't send your representative to the assembly, then we're actually undermining. And there's a really strong understanding that these things need to come from below. They need to take root on the ground, and they can't be imposed from above. Otherwise, they're just replicating the same dynamics as the Assad regime. So when it comes to laws, like really deep questions around, for example, like women's rights, women's liberation, the women's organizers say, we want to go in there and say, okay, no more polygamy, you can't do that, but they know that that's not an effective political strategy. So instead they grit their teeth, they smile, and they go in there and they talk to the women and they set up academies and they support the women who do kind of come to them and try to organize with them. So although I do think that kind of inner political tension and conflict and people with different visions is a challenge or a contradiction that the administration is working with, I'm actually incredibly hopeful that they have the political culture and practices and determination and commitment and just that kind of strength of belief of what they're working for and the understanding of where they're heading that makes them strong enough to be able to work with people who they really disagree with and say, hey, it's more important that you're here sitting around the table with us than that you're not. We'd rather have you in the room than out of the room. So that's a really amazing, probably one of the most important things I learned while I was over there, to really see how people can hold their beliefs while still kind of walking alongside people who they disagree with. And so other inner contradictions are, I mean, even so the standard of living, even though pretty much everybody has the basic needs met, because the communes, this is important, in addition to being these kind of like hubs of local democracy, they also have like material roles in distributing subsidized bread, in distributing subsidized gas so people can heat their houses and cook their food. If you want like certain kinds of like permits, permissions, registrations, things like that, you usually go through your commune. So they have a very sort of tangible impact on people's lives. But regardless, like even though like they are part of people's lives, a lot of people just don't engage in them. It's a change of mentality that people after decades and decades of being told, your opinion doesn't matter, you are kind of a subject that the state enacts itself upon, that you don't have kind of political agency. People need to learn, they need to relearn democracy, they need to relearn a political culture, which they put themselves at the center of as an agent, as somebody who can actually do something and get involved in. So instead of going, where's my gas, where's my bread, where's my permit, they go, okay, well, let's take full advantage. How can I be involved in this? How can I make my commune, my neighborhood, my district a better place to live? So that's a huge project that the movement has ahead of it. And there's been a lot of self kind of critical evaluation from the movement, where they kind of at some point about, I guess it was about a year and a half ago now, they were just like, the communes, they're not really working, not all of them. Some of them are. Some of them are amazing. A lot of them are okay. But some of them are just replicating that kind of state dynamic of people sort of acting as consumers and not actually participating in a democracy. And the co-chairs replicating that that relationship of like, well, we're in charge. And the movement reflected and said, we didn't do enough education. We didn't go out there and really talk to people about what does a commune mean? How is it different from what was before? What do we need from you? How do we make you feel empowered in this system? So they were starting to plan a whole series of like meetings and conferences in order to bring people together to really get people to engage in the system in a more proactive, democratic way. Unfortunately, just as all those meetings were meant to happen, there was the Turkish invasion was launched last October. So that was, you know, put on hold. And there's so many instances like that where there's inner contradictions and inner weaknesses and challenges which the movement is trying to address, but then can't address because it doesn't have the capacity or, you know, just the space to breathe in order to do it. The movement has a really amazing capacity of evaluating, self-criticizing, taking on board feedback, and then readjusting the course. You know, I've seen military commanders sit down and talk really openly about in the invasion of Afrin, this is something we did wrong and we shouldn't have done that. And next time we're going to do something different. And just the humility and the strength to be able to do that, to put yourself in that vulnerable position, say we did something wrong and it maybe cost lives or it cost the loss of territory, but it's more important that we admit that mistake so we can grow and learn from it than to hide it in order to look like we're infallible. It's really quite amazing. So I have a lot of faith in the movement's ability to adjust its course and to deal with those inner conflicts. But they need to be given the support and the resources and the space to do so. Another one of those problems is the fact that a lot of young people do want to leave, you know, northeast Syria. They do want to come to Europe or come to Iraq or even Turkey and kind of try to make money that they've kind of bought into this more kind of capitalist approach and don't see themselves as having enough opportunities in northeast Syria. And that's also a really difficult one because, you know, for me, like, you know, who am I to say, oh, no, you should stay here because, you know, I'm there as a visitor to learn and then I'll go back to where I'm from. But it's really a very interesting dynamic of kind of seeing people who kind of say, I want to get out of here. And how can you disagree with that? You know, like there's a lot of death. There's a lot of challenges, like life is harder and. But it's also a really, you know, I would love to go back there because there is something of being in a place which is a liberated territory, which feeds your soul in a way that neoliberal capitalism just doesn't do. But at the same time, you also have people, you know, Kurdish diaspora, people all over the world coming to Rojava and saying, yes, I know that, you know, the standard of life is lower, that the risk of that is higher, that the challenges are more extreme, but like it's a place I want to be and I want to stand with that project, and that's a really inspiring thing to see as well. And finally, do I have time to do the final question of the sort of agreement with the regime?
Yeah, sure. So Sarah is using host privileges. There's one extra question. But yeah, the brief answers to this, and we have a bit of time. And then we'll do the summing questions before the end.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's like quite a, you know, quick answer in that, as far as I'm aware, that, you know, the agreement that was made with the regime, you know, at the time in October, that was like a military agreement and all the sort of like political details hadn't been threshed out yet. As far as I'm aware, those talks, those kind of political talks about, well, what does it mean? Who gets to hold, you know, this responsibility, that authority, they're still ongoing. So how much is going to hamper it? Like, I mean, with the Turkish invasion, you know, like the administration was very much put on the back foot. So they've always been open to negotiation with the Assad regime. But when they were in a position where they said, well, we're getting invaded right now, we could really use some extra military power, they were then in a much weaker position for bargaining than they were before, which was really heartbreaking to see. you know, kind of feeling like how much will they lose at the negotiating table because of this. There is the reality that the Assad regime is in many ways very weak, that the army is, you know, the husk of an army that's just being sort of held up by Russia. But then at the same time, you know, Rojava is between a rock and a hard place and another hard place with, you know, Turkey, the Assad regime, and the fairly hostile KRG Barzani regime on the other. So in some ways, it's amazing that they've held out this long and achieved so much in this amount of time. But in some ways, like, I'm going to turn that question back around and say, like, well, what are we going to do to give them, like, the resources and power and support from it internationally to make sure that they are able to, like, hold more space at the negotiating table? It's not something that's just, like, something that we just passively observe. We're all political actors here. We're all here because we care about it and because we're finding what's happening in North and East Syria incredibly inspiring and something we want to stand by. So that's kind of, you know, we'll come to the shout outs at the end of the different campaigns and actions which are happening. But that's really something that we have influence over, and something, you know, when I was in Rojava in October and Turkey was invading and we were kind of watching all these sort of like empty declarations of support or condemnation of the invasion coming from all of our different governments around the world, followed up by virtually zero action, what I felt was a sense of failure in my social movements back home, that we hadn't built up the level of power and militants to be able to call our government to account and say, no, you need to actually remove all, you know, the permits for the weapons you're selling to the Turkish state. You know, you need to, like, act more strongly. And I think for me, like, I really felt shame that all across the world, we weren't able to put a stop to this invasion from where it was being funded, from where the weapons were being, you know, sold from, where they're being manufactured. And I think that's something that we would need to think about. How do we build up a movement that can support the administration to continue fighting for women's liberation and democracy and ecology in North and East Syria?
That was a really powerful answer. Thank you. So Sarah, do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about land ownership. And I mean, I know that quite a lot of land had previously been nationalized, but obviously it's really important in anything that we expect to be anti-capitalist, who does own the land and what sort of private property relations there are. So I wondered if you could say anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting. So in some ways, the administration was in a fairly, I guess, lucky situation in that when the regime was pushed out of the original region, so Afrin, Kobani and Jazeera in 2012, when the regime was kicked out, they left behind a lot of land that had been under regime ownership. So even though there are some bigger landlords in the regions, in the area, the administration never actually took land away from landlords who were still kind of around on some level, because there was just such a surplus of land from the regime. So for example, the tree cooperative, the tree nursery cooperative we used to go to kind of help out, to take cuttings, to buy saplings from, they were on former regime land, and they had acres and acres of land that they were able to use to transform into a tree nursery. Some of the kind of like women's institutes are in former regime bases. There's a whole area in one of the cities where lots of the kind of official offices are held that used to be like a regime quarter. And so actually with this kind of land and buildings and resources, the autonomous administration and the movement were able to say, okay, well, this is the space we're gonna use. That said, there is a political critique of mass land, private land ownership, and in some situations, the landlords are quite exploitative, and they really push down the people who work the land and get rich off the backs of exploitation. And there were some instances in which the people working the land organized, and with the sort of like quiet go-ahead of the administration, were able to then like kick out the landlord. and say, this is our land, we're working it, we've been working it for however long, and you're just sitting there and like making loads of money off of it, we'll have it back, please, thank you. And because they knew that they had the political backing of administration, they felt strong in being able to do that. That said, there's lots of situations in which there's landlords who are being really exploitative, but the people aren't organizing to overthrow them. And the stance of the administration, or at least the kind of officials and people I've spoken to, has been, we will let them know that we would support them if they wanted to reclaim, reappropriate this land. But until the initiative comes from them, we're not going to do it, because otherwise we're going to encourage them, go on, kick out your landlord. And then suddenly it's like, we're the new landlord. And they haven't got the kind of like social cohesion, political power in order to administrate it in a democratic way. Or someone else just emerges as a new landlord. So again, it's that kind of long-term perspective. And they were quite lucky in having a lot of regime land that they could take over instead. So they never actually got to the point where they, I mean, of course they have, you know, alienated, the movement will have alienated a lot of the kind of like more sort of upper class, richer sort of landowners or property owners, but never at the point of like people feeling like their livelihoods are being threatened by the presence of the administration.
Thanks, and thank you so much. That was 50 minutes of questions and answers. So it was really great. Thank you. So for the end, then, we thought, as you said at the beginning, the Kurdistan Solidarity Network, we exist first and foremost to start building movements for practical solidarity with the Kurdish Freedom Movement and the Rojava Revolution. But also we see ourselves as trying to learn from the practices of this movement and start to translate them so we can adopt and adapt these practices and political culture in our own situation in these islands. So we thought that for the end, it would be important to have some questions that brought out some of these issues a bit more. And I thought straight from the get-go, first question, just broad and easy, what struck you as really different from the political system in the United Kingdom? And do you think that we can start to transfer this system?
So I guess a few things that were really different. So one, there's the kind of like non-binary thinking. And in some ways I'm comparing the movement and administration in Rojava to the kind of broad left social movements we have in the UK. I'm not gonna compare so much with the UK state because it's kind of comparing like apples to oranges, whatever the expression is. So in general, there was that kind of ability to hold contradictions, to kind of have this non-binary approach to thinking and analysis where they kind of say, acknowledging that something isn't perfect, but still going for it without losing sight of the bigger picture. And really being able to work through contradictions and actually celebrate those contradictions to really say contradictions are good because it shows you where the conflict is. It shows you where you're gonna like have to struggle or you have to put more energy and focus. So that kind of celebration of when things get difficult was a really amazing and really eventually refreshing approach to political organizing. I think also what really struck me as very different was the kind of culture and political practice. There were kind of a lot of focus on education and then really rooting everything into a wider ideological framework. I think, you know, the democratic and federalist movement, even though it is in many ways like homegrown in North and East Syria, is very much taken on the ideological heritage of Abdullah Öcalan and the writings around democratic and federalism and democratic nation. And was really influenced by the fact that Abdullah Öcalan and many other leadership of the Kurdistan Workers' Party were based in Syria from the 70s. So there is this kind of common buy-in across the movement to the ideological framework. That doesn't mean that there aren't disagreements about how we apply it, how we interpret it, what we prioritize, but there was this kind of like concerted effort through like conversation and through a huge amount of education, like just really deep. Like, I mean, I think I spent in total probably like 3 months of my time there doing educational courses where like stuff is really broken down and examined and explained. And that is nothing compared to the level of education a lot of other people kind of enter into if they're, for example, being trained to do like diplomacy work or to be, yeah, kind of one of the community organizers or so on. So really kind of having that political ideology that coheres people, but also a political culture, which is incredibly inclusive, which has space for conflict and tension while still maintaining that we are stronger together. And I feel, at least in my personal experience of organizing in the UK, like I haven't really felt that kind of sense of like, however much we disagree, because we have this like common political understanding, we know that who our actual enemy is, like we know what we're up against. So therefore we're really gonna say, however much we disagree, we're gonna try our hardest to keep on fighting together because there's no way that we can do it without each other. And that absolute commitment to the collective. Part of it comes from just the general culture. Like individualism has really gone deep in the West, in like neoliberal states like the UK. So I think for me, like I didn't even realize how much my life was framed by like an individualist approach until I went to Rojava and really experienced what it felt like to be part of a really collective political movement. That's not to say that it doesn't exist in the UK. There's huge instances of like when people really band together and develop something collective. But it's a very different shift of political culture and general sort of social culture that makes it really different. And finally, the ability to think big, to really think, you know, in some ways you could say, well, they've already accomplished what a lot of people thought was impossible. So like, what's the next impossible thing to them? But really, like, it was probably the first time I sat around with a bunch of people who said, so global democratic and federalism, how are we going to get there? You know, and really thinking in these huge terms, while still kind of coping with the day-to-day stuff, as I mentioned before, but having the courage and the, I'm going to say, ambition and the political clarity to really know what's necessary and to really take it seriously and take themselves seriously and say, you know what, we are revolutionaries and we are connected to social movements all around the world. And it's our responsibility to like carry our burden, it's our privilege to carry that load of how do we as people in Northern Nigeria contribute towards the project of global democratic federalism, because it's not enough to have it here. We need to have it everywhere for it to be sustainable everywhere. So that was incredibly inspiring and strengthening. And I think that we could do with a little bit more of big picture thinking in the UK.
Thanks. And so then I think one of the things that's really come out in this meeting, and certainly something that we feel is really important for building practical solidarity, is knowing just how beautiful and different and dynamic and how much potential there is in this movement, and particularly in the revolution in Northern East Syria, and also knowing that it's not perfect, it's not utopia now, right? It's there are challenges, there are things that don't work so well, and there are connections that need to be overcome and worked through. So what would you say are the main challenges? What doesn't work so well in the system currently?
Mm-hmm. I think we probably touched on a lot of these. So there's obviously the kind of like wider like security defense situations, as well as the economic challenges. And there's also the challenges of not being able to access that kind of international humanitarian aid or access the political voice, you know, like the administration of Northern East Syria is excluded from the Geneva talks on the Syrian constitution. And I think that's a huge challenge, and that's really because of the paradigm that the rest of the world is operating in. And then, as I mentioned, the communes need to really come deeper. When communes were first envisioned, they tried to set them up so that it was something like between 1 and 200 people, but instead it became usually closer to 150 families. And in some of the biggest communes, it's over 2,000 people. And that's just, it's kind of too big to function properly as a more direct democracy kind of element. Because that's where the direct democracy resides. There's no assembly or council at the commune level. You start getting councils at the neighborhood and sub-district level, but in the commune, it's meant to be direct, and direct democracy with 2,000 people is really, really difficult because so much of the political culture relies on going around to people's houses and literally saying, hey, there's a meeting, do you want to come? What do you think about this? You should really get involved in this. Do you want to go to an education? Are you getting the kind of bread and gas and things that you're entitled to and so on? So, and that's just really hard to do. And it's a capacity issue, right? So the communes are a big challenge that if they really want to create a fundamentally different kind of politics, as opposed to like a governance structure, which is a government in everything but name, with a slightly more kind of humanitarian, socialist, you know, federated system, they really need to kind of shift the communes. And I think, yeah, that's a really big one. And then it's a mentality issue, because it's the same with the kind of shifting to a more cooperative economy. It's challenging when people still think in terms of a more capitalist, profit-orientated approach, a more state-orientated approach. So I think those are kind of all the internal challenges.
And so finally then, the sort of final mission statement that KSN has to start thinking about how we can adapt and apply these ideas to the UK. We already spoke a bit about how we could change our social movements, but how is democratic confederalism as a structure adaptable to the United Kingdom and to the to these islands, really?
Yeah, I think you know, like democratic confederalism isn't a blueprint, right? It's a series of principles and practices. So in many ways, like it's up to all of us to start having those conversations of what can it look like here. I think we could learn a lot from, you know, the experiences of Wales and Scotland and looking at how that's affected kind of more local organizing and sense of identity in those countries. And how we can kind of like shift our relationships to really, yeah, reconceptualize what, you know, how we can federate, like what our different regions are and so on. And I think it's just really like the kind of like Wales and Scotland, really identifying where in the UK do we have instances of local power, of community power, and whether it's in like local democracy initiatives or community centres and youth centres, which really include the local community and create a strong network of people who feel ownership of their place and of their kind of like sense of themselves as a community. I think that's really important. We need to identify those places where it's strongest, engage, build up, link together, and then also do the thing where we confederate that into a bigger picture. So not just leaving these things of local initiatives in different places, but really bringing them together so we have this big picture. Because I think it's really important to remember that the communes don't kind of exist in the absence of like a bigger picture. Like the reason why the communes and the confederal system works is because the whole system is geared towards that unit, that political unit. And it's not that it's meaningless if we just do that in the UK when the state isn't supporting it, but it's its own series of unique challenges. It's a lot more of a confrontational approach, I guess, in some way. So, you know, in Rojava, like the communes are supported and nurtured and held by the administration. You know, the autonomous administration was created in 2018 specifically to do the political task of building up the confederal system, to build up the communes. Whereas if you look more in the example of Bakur in the Kurdish region of Turkey, that also had a more confrontational relationship with the state because the Turkish state didn't want to devolve power. So I think we need to be looking at this kind of like, with one hand, like we build up our community power, our local democracy, and with the other, we kind of like push against the state. And then like with our brains, we're thinking about the big picture and we're generating like ideas and narratives and stories about what we're actually trying to accomplish so we can bring people in. So it's a bit of a juggling act, but I think we just need to keep all of those elements in mind and not just put all of our resources into one of them. So for example, there can be some engagement with electoral politics. Like I think, you know, getting people elected, especially to local government, can be a really important political tactic. But it can't exist separate from a broad-based, deeply rooted, and militant social movement and democratic community power. So we can't do one without the other. And we often have to start with the building up community power instead of electing someone into a position and expecting that to somehow generate a social movement. So yes, I think balancing sort of that anti-state perspective or state engagement perspective, building up community power, and really thinking about how we're transforming the ideas, the lens through which we're seeing our world and what we're trying to accomplish.
On that note, thank you so much, Fionn. That was a really, really rich talk and really thought-provoking and powerful answers. So thank you. And we hope that this has made you interested to find out more about democratic confederalism, but also the broader political paradigm of the Kurdish freedom movement. And if you are interested, then we have this education series, which is running at the moment. Here you can see it began yesterday with the question, is a revolutionary approach to politics in Britain possible? You can find that on our Facebook page for Kurdistan Solidarity Network, and you can rewatch that. Also watch out on Twitter at Kurdistan Solnet, and on Facebook soon we'll announce it on the website as a downloadable podcast. And then next Monday we'll talk more about what democracy looks like without a state. On the 1st of June, talk about the leading role of women in the revolution in Rojava, connecting personal change and system change on the 8th of June, and then what's next for social movements in these islands for the last session on the 15th of June. So we hope to have lots of you join us then, but those will also be podcasted and Facebook Live, as I said. Also in this meeting, we've had lots of discussion about practical support for Rojava and for the Kurdish freedom movement, and in particular trying to help overcome some of these external limitations that are imposed on the administration, and Fionn's answer before about the importance of us being able to help the autonomous administration overcome some of these more objective problems. So on Saturday, a new campaign was launched called Water for Rojava, which I will put the, let me just find it in this, sorry, in the, all the different screens that I've got open at the moment. So I will show you the website for that now and hand over to Joe, who is an organizer of this campaign.
Hi, yeah, thanks a lot. So yeah, as Nick said, it's a campaign called Water for Rojava. The kind of background for why we think this is such an important project at the moment is that essentially in an already desertifying region that's very much affected by climate change, in the time of a global pandemic, water is being used as a weapon of war. Water infrastructure and also electric infrastructure, which are often the same, right, because there's a lot of hydropower in the region, are being targeted, attacked, but also on a kind of longer term time frame, Turkey, the Turkish state, has been building a lot of dams, detaining the water flow into Rojava, Syria, Iraq as well, in fact, because Turkey is like the most upstream of those countries under Tigris and Euphrates, which then flow and feed into these other territories. So this is the problem. essentially a coalition of like cooperatives, small charities and associations and kind of others, mostly in Europe, but also in the Middle East, have come together to create a fund to be used for vital water infrastructure and water projects in Rojava in northeast Syria. So especially fixing damaged infrastructure, getting safe drinking water to people, but also supporting women's cooperatives, like we talked about before. So we're working especially with Aborigine, the women's economy, which is why I was able to, I literally copy pasted into the chat, if you saw that, some messages recently from our friends in the women's economy about cooperatives in the region. So yeah, it launched on Saturday at midday. It's already over £15,000. And we actually have a match funding pledge from a foundation who are matching £1 for every £1 that we raise. So it means essentially we already raised over £30,000, which is already 30% of the target. So it's really exciting. It's going to launch, it's going to run for another 3.5 weeks. So we're also adding new like donations all the time coming from organizations, co-ops, kind of well-known people and things like that. So keep an eye on the page and yeah, spread the word, support it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jo. And there's a couple of other campaigns that we wanted to use this platform to promote. So one, I think you can now see the Boycott website. Sarah can nod. Yep. Okay, good. So Boycott Turkey is the UK branch of the Boycott Turkey campaign was launched last year, around this time last year. It's boycott-turkey.net, building on a number of calls that have been coming out for several years now from Kurdish communities, also Turkish and Kurdish academics, and several other groups from within Turkey and in exile currently. Asking for a boycott of Turkey in both its goods, but particularly its tourism and the institutions that are supporting the Turkish state's violent actions, both within its borders and beyond. So this campaign launched our social media accounts last Monday. So you can find us on Instagram, on Facebook and on Twitter. And we'd really like to grow this into as broad-based a civil society campaign as possible. So there's lots of different ways to get involved. And if you'd like to contribute to this campaign, then please send us a message at KurdishSolidarityNetwork@riseup.net, because this is a really important way of putting pressure on the Turkish state and really building a broad base of support. And finally, the last campaign it will be in solidarity with a currently imprisoned YPG volunteer from the UK, who was imprisoned at the end of last year, has been held on remand since the end of last year, accused completely spuriously as ever of terrorism charges. Just a bit of background, this is often used by the British state as part of its really foreign relations with the Turkish state. Used to attempt to criminalize people who've been to northern East Syria to volunteer in various capacities and support the revolution. And they haven't successfully convicted anyone for this, but they're continuing to do so. And even in this case, combining it with the father and brother of another volunteer, Dan Newey, who's in northern East Syria at the moment, for so-called supporting them with that his acts of terrorism. So obviously this really shocking misuse of terrorism law and criminalization of solidarity. Their court case is set to begin on October 26th, and Sam and Paul are both on bail at the moment, but Dan Burke is still held in remand in Wandsworth Prison in London. So we're going to be launching a Free Dan Burke campaign in the coming weeks. Please look out for it. If you have messages of solidarity to send, you can get in touch. If there are ways in which you feel support, then please get in touch, because it's really disgusting, especially at the moment with the COVID crisis, that Dan is stuck in prison after everything that he did for the struggle and for all humanity. So I think that's all of my... one final shout out then. is if you enjoyed this session, and if you are a member of a group that you think could benefit from hearing about the experience on the ground in Rojava, from discussing some of these ideas, and if you'd like to discuss together with us how we can start to build a democratic movement, a dynamic social movement of the kinds that they've got on the ground in Kurdistan, then please get in touch with us at ksneducation@protonmail.com, because we'd really like to start running sessions like this, more dedicated, private, for particular groups across these islands, really anywhere that you are, and to start learning together how we can build democratic confederalism and really a free life for everyone, everywhere. So thank you very much to Scottish Solidarity with Kurdistan for having us. I'll hand over to Sarah now to close off the meeting. And thank you again to Vian for a really fantastic discussion.
Yes, thanks, Nick. Thanks, Vian. That was absolutely great. And yeah, I've got pages and pages of notes, actually. I want to end by saying thank you to you. Thanks to everybody for the questions and for the discussion. And just to remind people about the meeting in 2 weeks' time, which actually, you know, we've just heard about the case of the Nuis and Dan Burke. I mean, this whole criminalization of anybody who's trying to put forward these ideas and to support these ideas, and the use of terrorism legislation, is just appalling. And it's a really big issue, obviously, that the fact that you can't talk about the PKK without people saying it's a terrorist issue. So anyway, next in 2 weeks' time, we've got just a reminder that we've got Jan Furman, who is the lawyer who defended quite a few members of the PKK. It was for a very long period in the Belgian courts, right up through the whole court system, to basically say the PKK is not criminals, they're not terrorists, and successfully won that. So it's really exciting. I mean, obviously these legal things are very technical and particular issues in particular places, but it's a win and it's inspiring, and it can give us ideas of you know, how we can organize against this whole criminalization of this whole movement. So really hope to see a lot of you there, and great to see you here today. So thanks.